From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. It was not so long ago that there seemed to be no end in sight for the continual rise of greenhouse gas emissions across the globe. For centuries, the burning of fossil fuels had produced huge volumes of these planet-warming gases. And as the global population grew and nations across the planet reached development goals, the emissions went up and up and up. And now it seems possible, even likely, that we may have reached the point in which the emissions responsible for climate change are actually starting to fall, with multiple analyses over the past year concluding that 2024 will be the crucial inflection point in which we can say that we are finally moving in the right direction. Now, I do want to be clear about this. We will still be pumping tens of billions of metric tons of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere each year for many, many years to come. But if the projections are correct, next year will be just a little bit better than this year. And the year after that will be just a little bit better than that. And so while we have a long time to go before we reach the net zero emissions that may prevent the worst climate damages, there's nothing wrong with taking a little time to appreciate this moment. Appreciating this moment with us today is the lead author of a recent report that seeks to estimate when emissions will peak. Neil Grant is a senior climate and energy analyst at Climate Analytics, a global science and policy institute engaged around the world in driving and supporting climate action. His work explores energy system transitions and examines ways to achieve the Paris Agreement's temperature limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels. Grant is also a volunteer director for the North Kensington Community Energy Cooperative, which is working to install solar panels across some of the most iconic neighborhoods in London. Neil Grant, welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here with you.
Okay, so Neil, let's start with this. It's really hard to precisely measure emissions across the globe, like really hard. So how do you even go about that huge task?
I think there's lots of different ways that we can estimate emissions, and there's a range of different organizations doing a lot of that tracking. And these methods have different backgrounds. So there are some which are based in activity-based emissions measurements. So this is where you get some measures of fuel consumption in different countries, and you have some understanding of the emissions factors associated with burning coal, oil, and gas in different countries. Then you can get some estimates of the total fossil fuel emissions. And many estimates, such as those from the International Energy Agency, are based on this activity-based approach. But increasingly, as we go onwards, the new rises in satellite imagery and large data analysis of satellite imagery is providing new ways to monitor emissions. And so, for example, you've got new projects like Carbon Monitor, who are attempting to provide almost daily emissions estimates for carbon dioxide, which is based on satellite data tracking, you know, plumes over fossil fuel power plants, tracking activity data in the economy using satellite data, and using that to construct proxies. And like any scientific estimate, all of these estimates come with some level of uncertainty, but the more different lenses we have to try and estimate emissions, the better we're able to track what's really happening in the emissions space.
And when you look through all of those lenses together, when you put that picture together, what we see is some evidence of an impending peak in emissions. Now, you've written that the main warning sign, I guess, of an impending peak would be a slowdown in emissions growth. And we've seen that in recent years. I'm wondering, though, how much of that little sort of dip, even plateau that we've seen in the last few years, is hung up in the global slowdown that happened as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic?
You do see a dip that appears in 2020. You know, fossil fuel emissions fell around 5%, but we saw a very strong rebound immediately afterwards. And actually, the long-term impact of COVID on the emissions time series is rather minimal. And that's something that our report really sort of dived into, is looking at the difference between a one-off peak, where there's just a blip in emissions, versus a structural peak where there are long-term structural factors driving emissions reductions. If we look across the decade of 2012 to 2022, we're seeing already that slowing in emissions growth, which is really being driven by a range of factors, but including in that is the growth of renewables around the world.
And in fact, quite a few countries have already apparently reached their peak. I was surprised to read that the US actually reached its peak, presumably quite some time ago.
Yes, the US as a whole peaked emissions in the mid-2000s and has been declining gently since. Obviously, one thing that's really important to highlight is we're talking about wanting to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. We know that requires not only peaking, but rapid and accelerating reductions afterwards. And in many of those countries which have already peaked, which are largely in the OECD, then the reductions which have been coming post-peak have not been fast enough to be aligned with the 1.5 degree trajectory. And so while countries have peaked and they've shown it's possible to peak emissions, there's very few countries where you can say the rate of emissions reductions post-peak is in line with a Paris Agreement trajectory.
And one of the nations that may not have peaked yet is China, but there's lots of really positive signs coming out of China right now.
Absolutely. I mean, China is absolutely critical for the global emissions trajectory. You know, the growth in emissions that we've seen in the first part of this century has been significantly driven by growth in emissions in China. So what happens in China in the coming years will have a hugely significant impact on global emissions and global temperature outcomes. And it's correct to say that to date, you know, emissions in China have not peaked if we look at the historical data. And so in China, we see in the sort of national microcosm, the global peaking challenge, which is around the race between accelerating renewables deployment. We know that China is really leading the world in renewables deployment. We can talk more about the scale of that. And there's real reasons for hope and excitement when we see that.
Let's talk about the scale of renewable growth in China. This is fascinating. China installed more solar panels last year than the United States has installed in its entire history. That's amazing. I mean, they are rushing to solarize their grid.
Huge investment. And we're seeing that this year might actually, China's on track to overperform last year. You know, a really big question last year, the world as a whole added over 500 gigawatts of renewables. That's more than 50% above the amount that we added in 2022. And that was driven particularly by China, which added around 300 gigawatts of that total, and particularly by solar in China, which was over 200 gigawatts of that total. And the real question was, is that going to be a one-off year, or will we be able to sustain those record additions? And the evidence to date for this year is that actually China and the world is on track to beat 2023 in capacity additions. So that's a huge amount. And there's no signs that the Chinese solar revolution is slowing down.
The International Renewable Energy Agency actually documented in a 2022 report that there are now at least seven forms of renewable energy that make money at or beyond what fossil fuels generate. So there's lots of choices, too. It's not just solar or wind. We can make localized decisions for what is best for our regions in ways that are potentially profitable.
Exactly. While solar and wind will be the real driving horse of the energy transition, just because of the pace at which they're able to be deployed, their modular technologies, you know, there is large resources in all areas of the world. And so in the majority of the scenarios we analyze, wind and solar are responsible for over 90% of the capacity additions this decade in Paris-aligned scenarios. While they are the driving horse, it's really important not to forget the other renewables, geothermal, hydropower, concentrated solar power, and maybe more nascent technologies like ocean power, which will also play a role in their specific appropriate circumstances.
Renewables are profitable on the large scale, but at a small scale too. Your small energy cooperative in London is expected to see small annual dividends to investors, while also, and by the way, I love this model, while also raising tens of thousands of pounds for a fund that cooperative members then get to direct toward community needs. Talk a little bit about that.
Just briefly for your listeners to walk through the model for community energy. It's really a three-step model. So first off, we get investment from the community. We pool investment from members of the community, and we use that to buy solar panels. So those solar panels are not owned by a private company who is beholden to shareholder profit, but they're owned by the community. Secondly, we install those solar panels on community assets. So that could be churches, schools, community centers. And we sell the electricity both to the building and also export any excess to the grid. And with that, we make a profit. And that profit then can be used to generate value in the local community. So the power that we generate and the money that we make is then being split partly in a return to investors. So everyone who puts money in is getting money out on a competitive return. There's also a large chunk of the money which is then going into a community fund, which we're using to support girls' football clubs and boxing gyms in the area and gardening groups. And it's a great example of showing how local people can benefit from the renewables revolution. You know, renewables are cheap and renewables can make money. And I think it's really important to say that actually we can envisage and imagine a future in which that power that renewables give us is distributed and put into the hands of local communities.
So I love the optimism of this conversation at multiple scales. I do want to give us a little bit of a gut check here. The U.S. Energy Information Administration projects that energy-related CO2 emissions are either going to keep rising slightly or plateau for a little while. And then OPEC, the big oil conglomerate, has predicted that global demand for oil actually won't peak for another decade at least. There's still a lot of room for us to just sort of like kind of peak but plateau for a long time, right?
Absolutely. I would say, though, scenarios produced by actors are not value-free scientific exercises, but they have world-shaping potential. You know, scenarios are being used in a contested space to justify investment decisions, to convince different actors of taking particular courses. And I think it's pretty clear what OPEC's strategic interest in forecasting oil demand growth is. And so I would take their forecasts with a pinch of salt. But I think the real question to me is not will we peak emissions? I think the nature of the energy transition, the growth in renewables that we're seeing, and the way that I think all the dynamics suggest the energy transition will continue to accelerate, means that we know that we will peak emissions. The question is when.
How quickly could we actually draw down fossil fuels? Like, what I'm saying here is, like, how quickly could we get enough renewables online to replace the energy that oil and gas and coal are currently creating? If we, you know, as a globe truly said, yeah, we're committing to this.
So if we look at the latest global scenarios, then we see two key milestones. One is really deep emissions reductions by 2030. So for example, if we look at the IEA's latest net zero scenario, in this scenario, then fossil fuel emissions fall by about a third in 2030 relative to 2022 levels. And the second milestone which we see is achieving net zero CO2 emissions at or around 2050. And that's important because we know that warming will only stop when we reach net zero CO2 emissions. So even if we peak emissions and emissions start going down, then temperatures will continue to rise. We can control the rate of warming and slow that, and that's really important. But ultimately, we need to get to net zero to prevent continued temperature rise.
There's this whole sort of holistic thing that has to happen in order for climate action to be progressive toward these goals, right? It's not just carbon, it's grids. It's not just grids, it's storage. It's, you work on the Climate Action Tracker, which kind of tries to give an independent assessment of this holistic action by each nation. One of the tracker's mini tools is this global map showing the progress nations are making toward their part in reducing emissions enough to stave off climate warming beyond that 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels. It is a little depressing to look at. There are no countries right now that are deemed to be compliant on this tracker, really just a handful that are deemed almost sufficient. And even the United States, which just passed this landmark $390 billion climate solutions investment bill, is still deemed insufficient in its progress toward the goals. And China, which we've been talking about today a lot, and has made huge strides towards renewables, is still the world's largest emitter of carbon emissions. And so it's deemed highly insufficient. I mean, I'm not trying to put a damper on this conversation, but there is, I guess, just to emphasize, there's just so much work still to do everywhere in our globe.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this report we put out last year about peaking, we said that this year, if renewables continue to accelerate along historical trends, and there's some action to cut non-CO2 emissions, we found that there was a 70% chance that emissions could start falling in 2024. Now, it seems possible that actually that 30% chance that emissions don't fall might actually be the reality this year. There's a few factors which are potentially going to be headwinds against the achievement of peaking last year. But even if we do peak emissions this year, or we peak emissions next year, in that scenario that we were modelling, emissions would fall 10% by 2030 relative to current levels. Just to remind you that in the IEA's net zero scenario, emissions fall 30%. And in some of the IPCC scenarios, the cuts are closer to 40%. So, you know, even peaking is only the start of the journey. And so I think when we think about what is required to achieve 1.5 degrees, we need to have an honest conversation that the changes which are required are unprecedented in scale, in rapidity. You know, we need to fundamentally redesign our energy systems and economies in a fairly radical way. Now, I think the very good news is that we are seeing, we're in the foothills of this new industrial revolution of renewables. And I do think those changes are possible, but we have to be clear-eyed about the scale of them.
And it's not just the things that we often think about that matters. You know, we talk about carbon a lot. You've written that peaking fossil CO2 is obviously key, but we need to peak all emissions. That means methane too. What do we know about whether or when methane will peak?
Yes. So the first thing to highlight here is that in the reporting of greenhouse gases, there's always a time lag, right? Normally towards the end of any given calendar year, first estimates for what's happened to CO2 emissions come out. But usually non-CO2 emissions, due to differences in the reporting conventions and how they're tracked, usually there's a bit more of a lag. So actually, in 2024, we're only just getting the first estimates of what happened to methane emissions in 2022 out now. There's a two-year lag. And that makes tracking what's happening with methane real-time quite difficult. Based on the latest data, currently global methane emissions are rising at the fastest rate in decades. So at least out to 2022, we've not seen any bending of the curve of methane. Emissions are still rising at a very rapid rate.
And just to put this into some context, methane is like 28 times more powerful as a warming gas than carbon is?
Oh, on a 100-year timescale. If we look over only at a 20-year timescale, then methane is more like 80 times more powerful than CO2. So in terms of controlling near-term heating and near-term climate impacts, then controlling methane emissions is critically important.
What are the mitigative actions that have the best chance of drawing down methane emissions?
Well, it's best to split methane into its different categories. So where does methane emissions come from? A large chunk comes from the extraction of fossil fuels, where fugitive emissions in the upstream processes leak large amounts of methane into the atmosphere. Now, that's both from coal mines and also from oil and gas extraction. And in oil and gas extraction, then there's two key ways to cut methane emissions. First is to cut these fugitive emissions. So, you know, that's radar and other monitoring mechanisms to identify leaks and plug them as soon as they arrive. That's ending routine flaring of methane. And the IEA, the International Energy Agency, has made it very clear that many of these actions are cost effective because what do you save? You save methane. What is methane? It's natural gas, which is the exact fuel that you're extracting and trying to sell. So many of these actions are negative cost. And I think it's an absolute scandal that fossil fuel producers have not been implementing the best available standards in controlling methane emissions. Now, that in itself could cut methane emissions quite significantly. But the other way to cut methane emissions from fossil fuel production is to not dig up the fossil fuels in the first place. And that's, I think, a really important point to make. As we transition away from fossil fuels, we will cut fossil methane emissions as well, because they are associated with the extraction of fossil fuels.
Well, we get sort of a double benefit from that.
We get a double benefit, exactly.
Let's come back to carbon, the big baddie. This is all happening, all the things that we're talking about, in a world in which we don't yet have carbon capture and storage at scale. But you've been harshly critical of carbon capture and storage, I should say, as it's practiced, maybe not conceptually, but as it's practiced, because it creates this illusion that we can continue to use fossil fuels without consequence. And you were focused in your PhD studies at the Grantham Institute for Climate Change and the Environment at Imperial College London on this question of carbon capture. I want to take you back to, like, you know, a young, wide-eyed Neil Grant, you know, experiencing this idea of carbon capture for the first time and going like, wow, that's a great idea. And then realizing, you know, that it's really been bastardized in the way that it's been used, you know, not for or for abatement of you know, fossil fuel emissions, rather than, you know, all of the potential that it perhaps had. Was that just like a total bummer?
It's a great question. And actually, you capture very well my emotional experience as a young scientist, passionate about climate change, you know, deeply motivated to do this work because I'm concerned about the climate crisis. And I remember coming in thinking, wow, these models say CCS is really important, but we're not seeing any delivered. I should do some research to show how important CCS is. And really, as I then engaged in the models, I dug deep under the hood into sort of why many models show a structural bias towards large-scale CCS. And I looked more into the political economy of how CCS was being weaponized to abate not fossil fuels even, but abate the responsibility of fossil fuel producers to do anything. It was a real turning point for me. And I think, you know, my PhD studies took a significant change in direction to focus on this issue. And I thought, I need to, you know, provide a constructive criticism from within the discipline, from within academia, of saying, actually, these models, can they tell a different story? And if they do, what would be the implications of that? So yeah, very much that was my sort of emotional experience as an early stage PhD student.
Neil, a lot of climate scientists have these kinds of experiences. You know, they see the sausage made, so to speak, and they get pretty cynical. You're certainly critical, but you also seem to be so damned optimistic. How does that happen?
I don't define myself as optimistic, because to me, I see optimism as a general feeling about whether things will turn out okay or not, which in some ways denies agency. What I do feel is hopeful, and I define hope as knowing that we still, as a human civilization and as individuals, have agency to take action on climate change. Now, I'm not able to stand here and say to you with any confidence what level of temperatures we will see as a result in the future. You know, the future is as yet unwritten, and it's up to us to shape it. But what I can say is I know, and I fundamentally believe, that we as individuals and as communities and as nations do still have agency to cut emissions, and in doing so, limit the worst excesses of global warming. And ultimately, every 0.1 degree matters. But we have agency, so let's take it.
That's Neil Grant. He is a senior climate and energy analyst at Climate Analytics. which is a global climate science and policy institute engaged around the world in driving and supporting climate action. His work explores energy system transitions and examines ways to achieve the Paris Agreement's temperature limits of 1.5 Celsius over pre-industrial levels. Neil Grant, thank you.
Thank you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. And from listeners like you, you can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.